The last talk, I think, was a nice introduction to what I want to talk about. I want to talk about next-generation sequencing, but I want to talk about it as a role in the clinic. I'm an oncologist, breast oncologist by training, and what I want to focus in is the relevance now of next-generation sequencing to clinical cancer care. Scott Lippman this morning alluded to the fact that lung cancer was really just two kinds of cancer not that many years ago. This is 10 years ago. I think non-small cell lung cancer pretty much looked like the left circle, and now, as many of the clinicians in the audience know, it looks more like the right circle. We helped discover the KIF5B RET translocation. In fact, it was the first clinical case we had, was a novel translocation. And I think part of the reason that next-generation sequencing, I think, does have a role currently in the clinic is that this is what the clinician has to face, especially in lung cancer, where the numbers of biopsies that are very small amounts of tissue is increasing. To send out for all of these different markers is getting to be more and more difficult. And I think, hopefully, I can convince you next-generation sequencing does fill a goal in that particular situation of being able to come up with these different alterations in very small amounts of tissue. This is pretty much the concern. We're resourceful in Boston. I brought my own marker. This is the concern that clinicians have. When you have a new diagnosis, what do you send out for? Different hospitals, different clinics have different panels for lung cancer, for example. Many places you'll get EMO4-ALK, EGFR, KRAS, and ROS1. Others you'll get different combinations. Again, the amount of tissue, though, that one has to deal with is smaller and smaller, and the number of alterations, as many of you can appreciate, is going to be going up and up. So you're going to reach a difficult situation, amount of tissue versus number of markers you need to get. That's what put Foundation Medicine, I think, on the map. These are our founders. We represent the Boston-Cambridge sort of the biotech corridor. And these are researchers in the next-generation sequencing space from the Broad Institute and Dana-Farber, who realize that this isn't just a research technique anymore. We spent the first year or so of the company perfecting next-generation sequencing on paraffin tissue. That's the tissue that's available in the clinic. That's the tissue, I think, that needs to be used for clinically relevant next-generation sequencing. And just so everybody knows what the report looks like, I won't spend much more time on it, but we do sequence a very small amounts of tissue. We can get by with 50 nanograms of DNA, the equivalent of about 40 microns depth of tissue, so roughly 8 to 10 microscope slides. We result a report that looks pretty much like this. Here you see the relevant alterations listed with some of the therapeutic implications. So what I want to focus the next 10 to 12 minutes on are four lessons learned from the tests that we've performed. We performed over 2,000 tests now. The tests became available, by and large, at last ASCO, which was when we had our launch. And I think we've come up with four, probably more, but I'll concentrate on these four lessons that we've learned from running over 2,000 clinical samples. The first is that next-generation sequencing can be applied robustly and in a clinically relevant time frame for routine clinical samples. This is our process. We use, as I say, fixed paraffin-embedded samples, either slides or blocks. We can work with either one. The secret sauce is really here, preparing the DNA before it goes in the sequencer, and here, preparing the report. So we do DNA extraction. We quantitate the amount of DNA, do library construction, hybrid capture. Currently, we use the Illumina HiSeq 2000, switching over to the 2500s. We're technology agnostic in the sense that we'll go with whatever platform we feel is the best. There's nothing magic about this part. We use the machines per the recommendation of the manufacturer. But coming up with high-quality DNA samples is something that we've perfected. And after we have the results, our sort of proprietary algorithms to come up with all four types of alterations, point mutations, short indels, copy number alterations, and rearrangements through next-generation sequencing is something that we've also spent a lot of time on. And then finally, producing the report that you saw, which is curated and hopefully something that the clinician can understand. It's important to note that we are able to come up with all four types of alterations. A lot of the hotspot testing and other types of testing really struggle with coming up with these types, and we can do all four and do come up with all four on our report. So let's look at the first 2,000-plus cases. We did not tell clinicians what cases they should be sending in. We let them sort of get aware of the technology, and then send in those cases they felt were going to be helpful. And it turns out we received samples from most of the major tumor types, as you can see. I think the interesting learning is that about 10% of what we get sent are unknown primaries. We're not an unknown primary test. We don't come up with a diagnosis as to what the primary is specifically, though, of course, sometimes the genomic profile can help tell what indeed the primary is. The other group that we're getting a fair amount of is rare tumors. And I think what these two have in common is that there is no sort of standard accepted great therapy for either one of those. So physicians are looking for targets in both the rare tumor situation and the unknown primary. These particular samples that we're getting are mostly advanced cases. Patients have been through the standard therapies, and they're still viable, and so physicians are looking for something other than, let's say, pulling the next chemo regimen off the shelf. The important point about this slide, getting back to that first point, is in 95% of the time, if we get enough tissue, we can come up with the result. It's a very robust methodology the way we do it, and our turnaround time now is running 14 days, actually less than that on many of the samples. So we feel that this does fit into the clinical practice methodology really quite well. Last point on this slide, we find an average of 3 alterations per sample. We don't find 30, we don't find 40. We report out those alterations that we feel are biologic drivers. And this is, I think, somewhat reassuring to the clinician in the sense that there isn't, as I say, 20 or 30 alterations to get your arms around on any given report. Second point, next-generation sequencing provides more actionable information than standard genomic or what we call hotspot testing. I should define actionable briefly. Actionable to us means we find an alteration for which there's an FDA-approved drug on-label, an FDA-approved drug off-label against that alteration but in a different tumor type, or there's a clinical trial that has the alteration as an entry criteria. What we see is if we define hotspot testing, including Snapshot, the Dana-Farber test, OncoCarta, OncoMap, and then some of the alterations, amplifications, only about 27% of the actionable alterations are found by these non-next-generation sequencing techniques. And I think that's really the advantage in a nutshell of next-gen sequencing. We don't have any particular panel. We do exactly the same test on all solid tumors. We don't have any presupposition as to what you're going to find. And as you'll see, we find some of the common alterations in uncommon tumor types. I think that's one of the big advantages. And again, 62% of these 2,200 cases have at least one actionable alteration that would not have been detected by any other current methodology other than next-generation sequencing. And basically that's because you're not looking for the particular alteration in that particular tumor type. This is a busy slide, but it basically shows of those samples, over 75% that have at least one actionable alteration, the particular genes and the frequency in which we find different alterations. So I won't go through this, but we call this our long tail slide. The point is that some of these genes are altered in a vast minority of the cases, but you don't know in the particular case that you're testing what you're going to find until you test for it. I think that's really the key. The third point I want to make, and this is something I think that's controversial. We find targets, we find them off-label, and the question we always get is the target going to be effective? Is a drug against that target going to work off-label? The example that's always used is the V600E in colon carcinoma, where we know vemurafenib is not all that successful. I can tell you that generally speaking, and this is not going to satisfy the statisticians in the audience, but generally speaking, targeted therapies are effective off-label. We're getting the data to sort of back up that conclusion. As you can imagine, we give the results to the clinician, and we don't always get back what happens to that particular patient. So we are starting a registry. We are working with different centers to close that loop to get the clinical information back. But we have enough case reports now to know that, generally speaking, if there is a target, and I'll give a couple of examples, the targeted drug against it will work in the particular tumor type. Of course, we don't know what the denominator is. We don't know how many times it doesn't work, but it certainly can work in a number of situations, and I'll give you some examples of that. This just shows, and I think, you know, we've all seen slides like this, that targeted therapy can be quite effective. Of course, the problem is sometimes this result 15 days later looks like that again. So you don't always get durable responses. But there's no doubt that targeted therapy can be very effective. Let me give you just two tidbits of cases that we found, and I could give you more and more of these if anybody's interested. But it gives you a flavor of the kinds of findings we have and the benefits of this approach. This is a 53-year-old lady with inflammatory breast carcinoma, diagnosed in June of 2010, metastatic at diagnosis, had standard chemotherapy, some improvement, but certainly with inflammatory breast, did not have a tremendous response, progressed within 12 months, additional regimens tried, rapid progression of disease in November of 2011, and our test was performed. Well, we found, for the first time, we're able to discover an activating EGFR alteration, a common one in lung cancer, in this inflammatory breast cancer. So, of course, that raises the question, will one of the anti-EGFR agents work in this particular situation? No data whatsoever. Well, it takes an oncologist and it takes the proper patient situation to give a try of an agent when there's no data. And indeed, in this particular case, the patient was put on erlotinib. And as I say, this is a common point mutation, about 10% of lung cancer cases, certainly is a good responder predictor for erlotinib. The patient was put on erlotinib and had a very nice response. You can see here change in the PET CT scan over just a couple of months. And the patient is still responding as of last month when I was talking to the clinician. So this is an N of one. And we'll talk in my final minute or two about how to deal with N of 1 data, but we have multiple cases like this. How many patients would not respond to erlotinib? I don't know. That's going to be the $64 question, but the point is certainly patients can respond. So quickly, a second case. This is a 43-year-old nervous smoker, had adenocarcinoma of the lung, had the Vice's FISH test, looking for EML4-ALK, which was negative, had the other standard testing, begun on chemotherapy, did not have successful chemotherapy response. The Foundation Medicine test was ordered. And we found a novel ALK rearrangement intron 19. It was not EML4 as the fusion partner in this particular case. So again, and I think you can see the theme here, the question is, would crizotinib work in this particular situation? There was theoretical evidence to think that it would. And in fact, the patient was started on crizotinib, and you can see here in this particular series of scans that there was nice clinical improvement which persisted over 6 months in this particular case. And this, in fact, was written up in JTO several months ago. And we have, I say, multiple cases like this. As we get our registry up and running, as we get the clinical information back, we'll have a sense as to how many situations like this will happen. But it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to do clinical studies like this because these alterations can be relatively rare in the particular tumor type. So finally, to finish up, the last question that I can't answer today, but at least raise as sort of a discussion point, clinical trial paradigms for target agents must change given the presence of the same targets across tumors and the infrequent nature of these targets. How do you do clinical trials in situations like this where we're discovering relatively rare alterations? How do you convince insurance companies to pay for crizotinib when there's an EML4-ALK negative case so it doesn't fit their standard definition? I don't have an answer for that, but I think it's something that we're going to face as more and more companies like ours become available. How many case reports are going to be necessary? If we come up with that one case report, will the insurance company pay for off-label crizotinib for the second case? Will it take 10 case reports? I, again, don't know the answer to that. This is sort of uncharted territory, but I think it is something we're going to have to face as we go forward. And then finally, just an example of the kinds of alterations we've seen across different tumor types. As a breast oncologist, of course, very familiar with ERBB2 amplifications, we have now seen ERBB2 amplifications and activating mutations in over 15 different solid tumors, half of which we know have responded to anti-HER2 agents. And the difference in ratio of amplifications versus activating mutations varies. In lung cancer, the activating mutations are more common. In breast cancer, the amplifications are are more common. So it's this kind of data, I think, that really potentially can change the way patients are being treated. So last slide from Michael Link, former ASCO president. I think we really are undergoing a change in the way we're thinking about markers, targeted therapy, and hopefully I've convinced you that next-generation sequencing is going to have an impact as we go forward as oncologists in how to approach these patients. Thank you.